Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. We're going to talk about guns this hour of the program. The NRA just finished its convention in St. Louis. George Zimmerman has been arrested. We're talking about stand your ground laws all over the country. And here we are going to talk with two guests about guns in America. Jeff Nace will join us, the first part of the program, president of the Wisconsin Firearm Owners, Rangers, Clubs, and Educators. It is an NRA state chartered association. Later in the hour, Josh Sugarman will join us, founder and executive director of the Violence Policy Center. I think all I have to do on this issue is give the phone number and you will be calling in. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. And you can also post your comments. Can you say that? On our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Rhonda Fanning will be answering phone calls this morning. She'll chat with you briefly and get you on hold, and we'll be hearing your thoughts about all of the aforementioned topics. Jeff Nace, thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning.
Good morning. As a result of what happened in Florida, the Trayvon Martin case, we are having a bit of a national conversation about stand your ground. Is that a worthwhile conversation for us to have?
Not based on the Florida incident, just because we don't know what happened in Florida yet. At least I don't. Now, you may have information that I don't, but we really don't know, you know, all the details in that yet. So it may or may not. So I would never rush the judgment on anybody until we know all the facts.
Mm-hmm. I don't fully understand that law. Can you please tell me what it is, what it gives you, when it gives you the right to use your weapon?
Well, it basically, stand your ground means any place you have a right to be, you have a right to be. It's fairly simple. Naturally, when it's written in the law, it becomes much more complex. But the basic premise is that if you have a right to be somewhere, that you don't have to leave that particular place. There's a lot of issues when it comes to going away from a confrontation, because there's a lot of safety concerns about turning your back on an attacker, and the law basically allows your or recognizes your right to be somewhere is all it does. You're still required to meet all the conditions of using any type of force.
Why do you think that it has created such a national uproar?
The media. Yeah, the media. They publicize, again, without knowing the facts, they put things out there that may or may not be true. We don't know that, or at least I don't. You know, like I said, there may be information, and it'll all come out, I believe. But it's just, things were put out there right away that I don't even know if stand your ground comes into play with this. I've heard so many different stories, I just quit listening to it until we get the facts straight.
Mm-hmm. You think it's a good law?
So I think allowing citizens or recognizing citizens' constitutional rights is a great thing. You should have, if you have a right to be somewhere, why would you ever want to, why wouldn't that be recognized? And this just acknowledges that, I guess. So, yes, I think stand your ground or castle doctrine, all those, recognizing your right to be there is a good thing.
At what point do you think somebody should forsake the right to hold a weapon? Zimmerman evidently did have an arrest record that included an assault and domestic violence complaints. Should people like that be restricted from having guns, do you think, or not?
I'd have to see exactly what was involved, and that's something that I would think the judge in the case would be able to, they can restrict some of your rights depending on how your, the punishment is for what you did wrong. So, without being able to analyze all that, I couldn't make a judgment either way.
And when it comes to people being able to walk down the street with a loaded weapon, I want to hear your thoughts about, I assume you would believe that will make us a safer society. Would it?
Well, it does. I mean, it's not a question that there's, that especially the, Wisconsin's been a long time in coming to restoring our rights to defend ourselves. And I'm not only a pro-gun person, but I'm also a self-defense professional. So You know, there's certain people that do not have the physical ability to fend off an attacker, even if that attacker isn't armed. You know, when you can guarantee that all the criminals, the people that misuse, you know, baseball bats and firearms and knives, when you can guarantee that they no longer will use them or attack people, then we can talk about, you know, disarming honest and honest law-abiding citizens. Till that time, I want you to be able to protect yourself. And if you choose to do that with a firearm, I support that.
Mm-hmm. If you don't mind my asking, and you don't have to say what the answer is, but when you walk down the street, when you get ready for your day and go out of the house, do you carry a gun?
I carry constantly.
You do?
Yes, I have for years. We in Wisconsin, you could legally carry in your own home, in your own business, and have done though. And the reason I did so is because I wanted, when I started teaching classes, as I assumed we were going to get some of our civil rights back sometime in the future, I wanted to be able to run classes, educate people with experience, meaning that when I crawl underneath the car to change oil, I can tell you which holsters work and which don't.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel it makes you safer? Do you worry that somebody will be attacking you during the course of the day?
Well, no more than putting a safety belt on. When I'm not really worried about getting in an accident, but we're still supposed to wear a safety belt. So I would say to you that carrying a firearm, especially for a female, I think is more important than a safety belt is. And I base that on, there's an old martial arts statistic that's out there that I'm trying to find the source of it, and I believe it's FBI, that says either 1 in 4 women or 3 in 4 women, depending who you talk to, are going to be attacked in their lifetime. And I'm not so sure that 1 in 4 women will be in a car accident where a safety belt will make a difference in their lifetime. So with that type of statistics, I would assume that women should be carrying firearms more than wearing their safety belt.
Women are starting to carry more firearms, aren't they?
Yeah.
I noticed that was a big part of the NRA convention.
Yes, it is. As I said, I've been teaching self-defense for 25 years, and no matter what I teach you, if you come in for a 4-hour seminar, I can safely teach you at least the beginning of defending yourself with a firearm. 4 hours in self-defense hand-to-hand is not going to make you equal to a male attacker, as an example.
Uh-huh.
You know, I can make you smarter. Actually, what I did in most of the classes, I educated on how to stay out of trouble, how not to get into that position, is much more effective than teaching you punches and kicks and throws and things like that. But it takes much longer to perfect.
You mentioned, Jeff, a 4-hour seminar. Is that required to get a handgun in this state? Do you have to take a seminar like yours?
No, in Wisconsin, what you have to show is proof of some type of training. The whole premise of the law when we were designing this or having input on the law as it became was that everybody has different needs. Some people need, you know, much more training than others. Myself, I need more than my 80-year-old mother does. My 80-year-old mother lives way up north. She's never goes to places, you know, that are even remotely would be considered high risk at all, even though she could be at risk right in her own home or in her own, very own area. But she's 80 years old also, so she needs a different type of training than I do, who travel the state and actually a lot of different states in the country and interact with people in a different way. So the law in Wisconsin was set up so that each individual could get the training that they needed for their purposes.
Do you think it's sufficient? Do you think we need a lot of training, extensive training, if we're going to carry a firearm?
No.
You don't think so?
I don't think. No, because there's too many variables involved there. And as soon as you do that, as soon as you put an extensive amount of training on, you hurt a lot of the people that really need to carry. Poor people in inner cities especially don't have the access to ranges and don't maybe have the resources. Single moms with a couple of kids don't have the resources to pay for these, you know, elaborate courses. The course that I run, the most expensive one, would run you about $1,000 to do the whole course.
Wow.
You know, it's very advanced, and it's an excellent course. It's just that my mother is not going to pay $1,000 for that. It's just not something she can feasibly do. We would like to see it in the high schools, for sure, as they become adults. They should understand their constitutional rights, and firearm safety actually from kindergarten on would be a great thing, especially in Wisconsin, where most of the homes have firearms in them for, say, deer hunting or other activities. Firearm safety in the school, public school systems, we think would be an excellent idea just for safety's sake.
Mm-hmm. And what about the accessibility of guns? We have heard that it's pretty darn easy to get a gun in this country, that maybe 40 or 50% of the guns that are purchased require no background check at all, which frightens a lot of people.
Yeah, again, it's one of those things that when they go through and they actually analyze it, you know, the criminals use stolen firearms, generally not ones that are purchased. And so, again, the background check affects people that are legally purchasing. You know, when you start stealing things, again, naturally that doesn't come into play. Again, with the number of firearms in the country, the accessibility even of imported firearms, and I say that because we cannot stop the drug flow into this country. So if they bring in a case of AK-47s along with all the tons of cocaine they haul, you know, bring into the country, we can't stop the cocaine. The firearms is a secondary thing they can bring in very easily. So, no, that I don't see as a proper way to handle it at all.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. We have our lines all filled, so here we go. Our number is 800-486-8655, and our guest this part of the show is Jeff Nace. He is president of Wisconsin Firearm Owners, Rangers, Clubs, and Educators, which is an NRIA state chartered association, and does seminars, as you heard him say, to teach people how to use weapons, and also teaches self-defense. Jake in Stevens Point is our first caller. Hi, Jake.
Hello. Thanks for having the show. I'm sort of curious. I guess his name is Jeff.
Yes.
Yeah. Hey there, Jeff. I'm wondering if you would be able to elaborate a little bit as regards to the laws federally and statewide regarding possession and ownership and purchase of people who have been adjudicated mentally defective, as well as people with felonies. And also, I kind of looked at the law, the state law, a little bit, and it mentioned something about people who have been adjudicated mentally defective aren't able to legally possess body armor. And I'm wondering what the definition of body armor is. And does that mean, like, a bike helmet or protective shin guards or anything like that? If you could elaborate, would be
sure. I can do the best I can. Again, I'm not a lawyer. I don't speak as any type of legal expert at all. You know, I want to put that out front. As far as who can own a firearm, once you've had some legal issues, that's something you need to check with your lawyer or the prosecutor or the judge or the court system. Will generally, they lay that right out to you. You cannot do this, this, and this, but whichever it may be, both federally and in state law. As far as the body armor goes, there's a lot of, I wouldn't be concerned that if you're buying a bike helmet or the shin guards, even if they're Kevlar, which Kevlar is a very good protective material, so it is used in a lot. It's used in tires. They have Kevlar belted tires also, so they use it in a lot of different ways, and so it is something that if you're concerned that you are legal to own a vest, and generally what's considered with that is protective clothing, whether it's a vest or a jacket that has ballistic resistance, I guess is the best way to say that, then you need to check into, you know, with your lawyer with that. But as far as anything that's for other purposes, I wouldn't be concerned with that at all.
We go to Dave in Wanakee. Hi, Dave.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Something happened recently during the most recent election where a man in a small town in Wisconsin went to go vote, and he was strapped with his .45, and he was walking around and making the poll workers down there very nervous. Nothing happened, but what if one of the poll workers decided that he was threatening and shot the guy? Would that have been justified? Are there places where guns should not be allowed?
Well, I guess what my first response to that is anybody using any type of force needs to be justified. You can't say, well, because I didn't feel good, I didn't like the way this person looked, I didn't like the fact that they were driving too fast or that they're carrying a gun, a holstered gun, would never meet legal standards for using that type of force. So, no, that's not the case at all. It's something that, and as far as places that you restrict firearms, if you want to make polling places, places that you cannot carry, then what you need to do is you need to have metal detectors and security at the doorway, along with lock boxes to allow us to lock up our firearms. Because whenever you post a building or an area against the legal carry of firearms, law-abiding citizens like myself lock them up and don't bring them in there. Unfortunately, the people that will misuse those firearms, that don't care about the law, that they're not going to obey a sign. If that's the case, as an example on a bank, when they used to have the no gun sign, I just suggest that instead of putting no guns in there, why don't you put no robberies? Because it basically does the same thing. The law-abiding citizen follows the rules and the criminals don't. It has no effect. So if you're going to, any place where they restrict your ability to defend yourself, they need then to provide that protection or security.
What about colleges?
Colleges, you know, I believe adults have a right to defend themselves. So I don't see, you know, I look at it, when I see a college is posted, if I'm a rapist, I know that the females there are not armed. Where's a better place to go than a place that doesn't allow the females to protect themselves? You know, I think it's scary that we don't allow it, because it's kind of an open for business sign that they restrict that. There's a couple of small universities up in my area that post, and these young girls are coming into it. They're the place, but it's a small, not online college, but that type of, it's not a big full-blown campus like, you know, in years past. And they have signs all over the place that you cannot carry in there. But these girls are in there at 9, 10 o'clock at night getting done with courses and going out to their cars. This really leaves accessibility to unarmed or unprotected females open to attackers. And it's kind of a scary thought.
Here's an email that's come in from Bill in Wausau. Jeff, how many times have you drawn your firearm in self-defense? How many people do you know personally in Wisconsin who have drawn a firearm in self-defense?
I don't know any private citizens. I do know a few law enforcement officers, and I wouldn't necessarily state that all of them were in self-defense. They were in line of duty, I would put it as more of a correct term for the law enforcement officers that I've dealt with. But no, I've never, I've also never hit anybody in self-defense in the last 30 years or so. So it's not, something that I still trained in martial arts for years and years. It's not something that you ever want to do. It's just that you have the ability to ensure that, if you need to, that the accessibility of that self-defense is there.
There are a lot of police associations, and in Florida, I know there are a number of prominent officials in the law enforcement field who have deep concerns about Stand Your Ground, although we are learning the details of the Trayvon Martin case. There were concerns, and George Zimmerman was told to back off on this and let the police take care of this. There have been a lot of people saying that what we're doing is allowing people to be vigilantes, and that's what George Zimmerman saw himself as. Even though the police told him, don't do this, he sort of took the matter in his own hands, the law in his own hands, and somebody died as a result of it.
Well, I don't necessarily know you can say what you just said, just because I don't know those as facts. I mean, I do know that the 911 thing, I did hear that he was told to, you know, back off. And then I've also heard that he did back off. So I don't know that, and that goes back to I don't really want to comment on that case because I don't have all the facts, and I don't want to, you know, misrepresent anything at all. But as far as Stand Your Ground goes, I'm not sure. First of all the criteria for using lethal force or any type of force still has to be met, no matter if you have Stand Your Ground or not. What that recognizes is that the duty to retreat is eliminated to a degree. Because retreating, as an example, there's some people that, feel that you should have to retreat out of your own home. If somebody kicks in the front door, you shouldn't be able to defend yourself. You should have to go out the back door. I actually know law enforcement agencies that have recommended that to people that were being threatened. The problem with that is that if I kick in your front door and you head out the back, how do you know I don't have an accomplice out the back door? If my goal is to get you, you know, going out the back door may be the worst scenario for you to do. And it is your own home. And Stand Your Ground is basically an extension of that. If you have a right to be walking to your car from your place of business or from your employment place of employment, you have a right to be there. So it puts the onus on the prosecutor, if they felt that you did something illegal, to prove that you didn't have a right to be there. You went somewhere you're not supposed to be, which would come into play if the Florida cases, if he was somewhere where he wasn't supposed to be, Mr. Zimmerman was somewhere where he wasn't supposed to be legally there, then he would have been in violation there. But again, we don't know that. It doesn't sound that way at all. But again, it does. All it does is recognize your right to be where you are.
More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, the Milwaukee Repertory Theater currently has a production of Othello, and we'll be speaking with the artistic director of the Rep, who is directing this particular show, and we'll speak with the actor who is playing Othello. It is done as motorcycle gangs. We'll find out why and talk some Shakespeare. Hour two of the program. A couple more phone calls for Jeff Nace, president of Wisconsin Firearm Owners, Rangers Clubs, and Educators, an NRA State Chartered Association. Mike in Lodi. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm a former NRA member. I've been handling firearms for as long as I can remember. Believer in concealed carry laws, and to a certain extent, I believe in the Stand Your Ground. However, I do strongly disagree with your guest in the need for training. And, you know, it's a fundamental belief of mine is that with rights come responsibilities. And in the case of carrying a deadly weapon where you are using or you're carrying it with the pretense that if you should get into a situation or a confrontation, then you have the option to defend yourself, I think it's just totally irresponsible not to have requirements or training so that every person that gets a concealed carry permit has a firm understanding of the basic operations of firearms. And I'm not talking proficiency, the basic operations, basic safety, and then most importantly, what their law, what their legal responsibilities and obligations are while they're carrying that firearm. And I nobody can convince me that that's not the way we should be doing it.
Jeff.
Yes. Well, I don't disagree with what he said. It's actually what I said before, is that each individual needs to get the training that they already don't have or that they need to know. It's not, I never said that there should be no training at all, but what we want to do is make sure that you're not doing training that is not necessarily for what you're not paying for training that is not necessary for you, for your reason to carry, or for the amount of time you carry or where you carry. Every single scenario is different. So we want to make sure that you're able to spend your money the most wisely and get the most education you can that pertains to you. Paying for something that doesn't pertain to you is a waste of your money and maybe not allow you to then get the advanced training that you need. So, and I would love to see it, like I said, in the high schools. Let's do all that. Let's explain your rights of self-defense. That is part of the Constitution. Why we're not teaching it in the schools, I'm not sure. But again, it's something that would be a great thing that everybody in high school gets that.
Mandate at least a minimum level of objectively defined criteria, or objectively defined goals, to assure that any training, these training programs which have no definition or curriculum or anything right now, would you support a change in the law or allowing Department of Justice to draw up a set of curriculum requirement that at minimum you have to address these certain items.
No, I would not, because the Department of Justice does not have the proper they don't have the proper training on what needs to be done. They have very good information on certain portions of it and not on others. Again, it's an individually, as you said before, you have rights. With your rights, you have responsibilities. And so it is your responsibility to make sure that you understand your rights and what you're allowed to do. It's the same as voting. We don't want to restrict people on voting. We don't have tests for voting, that they're well informed, that they're, you know, that they're making the right choice when they're in there. That is a personal responsibility, as is with the firearm. And you are 100% correct that individuals that plan on carrying, myself included, need to be educated so that we understand why, what we're, what authority, what responsibility, probably is the best word, when we're carrying a firearm.
Thank you very much for being with us, Jeff.
You bet.
Jeff Nace.
A quick note with that is it's Wisconsin Firearm Owners Ranges Clubs and Educators, because I don't want rangers calling me.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
No problem. But thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Just got an extra R in there. Jeff Nace, president of the Wisconsin Firearm Owners Ranges, Clubs, and Educators. We continue our conversation now, so stay on hold if that's where you are. Your calls will still be pertinent. Our guest now is Josh Sugarman, who's the founder and executive director of the Violence Policy Center. It's a national educational foundation working to reduce violence in America. He's the author of a couple books, National Rifle Association, Money, Firepower, and Fear, and Every Handgun is Aimed at You, the Case for Banning Handguns. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And the Facebook page you can use, that is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Josh.
Good morning.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So how serious a conversation are we having about concealed carry, stand your ground, as a result of Trayvon Martin?
I think we're having a very serious conversation, because for the first time, the debate has expanded beyond the traditional gun control participants, the NRA, the gun lobby, the gun industry, and the gun violence prevention groups. Because of the high-profile nature of the case, two things are happening. You're seeing new organizations getting involved. You're seeing the mechanism by which these laws are spread being revealed. And then finally, what you're finding is, I think, that a lot of people are learning about laws in their home states that they didn't know about, and people thought that gun violence couldn't affect them are now concerned that that possibility is very, very real.
What does stand your ground mean exactly? Is it pretty much the same in those states that have it?
It varies from state to state, but in a nutshell, we call them shoot-to-kill laws, because that really is what they're about, is that you're allowed to use lethal force outside the home, essentially, if you feel that you're threatened. There's no responsibility to try to walk away from the situation, and it's based on your personal feelings regarding the situation.
So it could be if somebody yells at you or yells obscenities, or that seems pretty vague to me.
Well, we have an ongoing project called Concealed Carry Killers, which is on our website, which is www.vpc.org. And we've looked at hundreds of cases. And quite often, where stand your ground or other self-defense arguments are offered, it's basically two guys get into an argument, someone shoves somebody else, eventually a gun or two guns are pulled. So really, it's the primary thing is you have no responsibility to back away from the situation. It's that you feel threatened, you feel your life is at risk based on your own judgment, and then you can pull the trigger. And unfortunately, you have instances like the Trayvon Martin shooting where the person who's on the other end of that fear ends up with their life being lost.
Mm-hmm. Have there been court challenges to this at all? Have there been a number of people who have said, you know, or people who are injured, they weren't killed as a result of a shot being fired at them. Listen, this person fired at me, and I wasn't that much of a threat. Can you prove that in court? I'm not a threat?
We have seen cases where civil litigation has followed those who've been injured, families of those who've been murdered. Unfortunately, because there's still limited data available, like, for example, our Concealed Carry Killers page, we have to use news stories to find incidents involving concealed handgun permit holders, because there is no national data collection. There's very, very limited local data collection, and in fact, in many states, they don't release the data. The NRA and the gun industry have worked to make sure this data isn't available so that, to be honest, they can fill this information vacuum with their own version of reality.
Tell me what it is about America, Josh, that allows people to, well, that makes people feel as though in order to be safe, in order to be on watch, in order to guard against, you know, the evils in society, they have to pretty much carry a gun all the time.
Well, I think the most important thing to understand when you talk about the gun issue in America is that whereas on the one hand it's always framed by the NRA and other organizations in terms of freedom and the Second Amendment, and all of a sudden you're back on, you know, Bunker Hill holding a flintlock, it's really all about selling guns. And the gun industry has become expert at marketing their weapons. The NRA, both through their legislative and public education activities, works as their trade association. So to look at this issue and to really understand, you have to understand in terms of like any other consumer product. And the reality is that household gun ownership in the U.S. is actually decreasing. For the past couple of decades, going from about half of all homes to a little less than a third today. And so things like concealed carry, things like marketing assault weapons, it's all done because they have to resell the primary market that is fading year by year. So I think that's the first issue. And the second is that in this country, you know, people have fear. People who live in big cities, people who don't live in big cities, people live in gated communities. And the question is, how do you deal with that fear? And unfortunately, the gun lobby and the gun industry have been very effective at offering guns as a solution, when the reality is guns are rarely used to kill criminals or stop crimes. And where there is a shooting and you do use a gun in self-defense, more often than not, that changes your life forever. And it's not just the emotional scars that you will have as the shooter, but as you mentioned earlier, oftentimes it does involve financial duress. Whether you're sued or not, you will go to court, you will be charged, and it changes you and your family's life forever.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the NRA convention. There has been, you talk about the marketing, a big drive during the past decade, evidently, to get women to buy guns. And I find this interesting. Their numbers, female numbers at shooting clinics, have gone up from 500 to 10,000 during the past decade, and they were a major presence at the NRA's recent convention.
Well, a lot of those numbers, I think, have to be looked with a very, very close eye. I mean, the NRA, once again, and groups like National Shooting Sports Foundation are expert at pitching the women are buying guns story. And they circulate every 3 or 4 years. And here's the format. They come out with some new poll or some new limited data saying that more women are buying guns. Then the press goes, local gun store, who says, oh, yes, more women are buying guns. And then the piece is put out there, and their marketing is done. According to the National Opinion Research Center, which does the General Social Survey, which is the most cited survey in the country, and done every 2 years, female gun ownership has essentially remained stagnant.
Really?
Yeah, between 9% and 13%, and that's the way it's always been. And there are peaks and there are valleys, but overall, it's remained stagnant. And the reason that there's such a pitch from the NRA to women is, once again, male gun ownership is declining. And as they say, if you get a female gun owner, you know, you don't just get her, you get the kids. And that's their goal.
Hmm. Let's go back to phone calls. Linda in Bristol. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I wish that I'd gotten through when Jeff was up still. I was kind of raging there, but I wanted to make a couple of points. First of all, he mentioned personal responsibility as far as getting trained. Well, and then he also brought up the comparison to voting incorrectly. Voting incorrectly, however you want to define that, doesn't hurt or kill anybody. So I am totally in disagreement with what he was saying about getting trained. It's not personal responsibility. It's responsibility to those around you who may be incorrectly gunned down, whether it's the potential perpetrator or innocent bystanders. He also mentioned, quote, the right to be there. Well, whose right was it to be there in the Trayvon Martin versus Zimmerman case? From what I understand, my take on it is that Trayvon wasn't even doing anything, and Okay, so Zimmerman felt threatened. That's what our police are there for. He wasn't in any imminent danger, and these laws enable people that feel threatened, whether they are really or not, to take matters into their own hands and become vigilantes. It's great in the movies, but in reality, I don't think it is. And I think that those who end up being the victims of those crimes, whether it's themselves or your son or daughter or sister or neighbor or whatever, will be hit by reality. It's a case where if you potentially are the wrong nationality or the wrong color or you're not dressed correctly or whatever and somebody feels threatened, this whole thing of stand your ground, I don't believe that people should be able to go out there and broach these things. I also believe that carrying guns around in this manner is going to lead to more crime because people sometimes get angry, whether it's being cut off in traffic. And I knew somebody that I worked with who had been shot at.
Oh.
Not in a bad area, but, because somebody got mad at what they did, and they shot at them. And this just enables people. And then what happens when it goes to court? It gets thrown out, it was a moment of anger, and then somebody ends up dead. This is so wrong, this whole proliferation of guns. And I'm a gun owner myself. I have it, locked up. It's in my house. For whatever rare occasion, I'm probably not even going to keep it. But nonetheless, this whole thing of carrying them around, I totally disagree with. It's just way too easy to use these things, and you can't go back later. You shoot first, ask questions later. You can't go back later and bring this person back. I mean, this is huge. I'm sorry to be talking so fast.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
It gets me up, my back up.
Thank you. Thanks, Linda. Josh, wherever you want to start, she covered a lot of areas.
I have nothing to add. The caller has summed up the situation perfectly, and she's right, and I hope there are more people out there in Wisconsin across the country that share her views.
What about training? Does that vary from state to state, the requirements for training?
Training does vary from state to state, and I think the bigger issue is that there have been studies done showing that training really has very little effect on how people store their guns, use their guns, let alone carry their guns out in public. The idea that 4 hours of training or getting a hunting permit is going to suffice and have the same weight of constant, say, police training, the only other people who carry their guns in public and are allowed to use them for lethal purposes, really, if you stop and think about it, makes very little sense.
Yeah. Thanks, Linda. Bill in Madison, hi.
Hello. I feel very conflicted. I've listened to both these gentlemen, and each seems to represent an extremist position from my point of view. I'm less of the center on the political aisle on just about every issue except this one. The Supreme Court has said that the right to keep and bear arms is an individual right. So I think that's a matter of settled law. But more personally, I would have agreed with him almost entirely about 30 years ago. But then I went through a period of poverty. And I spent about 8 years living in a bad neighborhood, and there were homicides going on around me. By around me, I mean next door to me. Two homicides within 5 years, a home invasion, actually three home invasions if you count within a four-block radius of where I lived, meetings with the mayor, community meetings with the mayor and the police chief over these issues, and we all walked away with the sense that, yes, the police have decided as a matter of policy that our neighborhood was not a law enforcement priority. And so we were told, essentially, you cannot trust the police to protect you. So I started believing in carrying guns. And as far as this case in Florida, the other gentleman, Jeff, he was saying how he doesn't know the facts of the case and he can't believe the media. Well, that's clearly, it's dissonant with his point of view, so he doesn't want to believe it. But all the evidence reported by all the different media says that this guy was told to stand down and he went anyway. And in most states, in Wisconsin, I've checked, If you are told by a policeman to stand down and you go anyway, that automatically makes you the aggressor.
All right, let's get a response. Josh.
Well, obviously, we're very disappointed by the Heller decision, which overturned D.C.'s handgun ban. And to be honest, we think that is a renegade decision. and we think it will be revisited. If you read the dissent by the dissenting justices in the case, it's a very, very compelling argument against what almost comes across at times, to be honest, as a slapdash decision that Justice Scalia wrote. It seems much more political than judicial in its presentation and the sources cited. So that's the first issue. The second is that we don't agree that having a gun in the home for self-defense is a good idea, but even here in the district, people were allowed to have long guns, shotguns, rifles in their homes for self-defense. And if you talk to any pro-gun person in, you know, moments of honesty, they'll admit that is the best self-defense gun. Finally, though, I do think that the idea that you're going to carry a gun out in public and that is going to be your self-defense tool is just unwise and impractical. And when you look at the facts available, doesn't really work that well. I mean, literally, the number of people who use a handgun justifiably in self-defense this country is about 200 per year. Actually, it's about 170 in 2010. So it doesn't happen that often. You stack that against the risk that you run, as your caller mentioned, people get angry, people who domestic disputes, people who just get in arguments, as we catalog in our concealed carry killers data set, it vastly outweighs these numbers. And I think when you look at any sort of reasoned analysis of gun carrying, brings it back to, for the public safety, it's too great a risk.
Let's take a couple of Facebook messages. First one from Derek. I'll read both of them and then you can respond. I'm getting ready to apply for my permit as we speak. It's law in 49 states. It's our constitutional right to protect ourselves. The end. If you don't like it, don't get a permit. If you're afraid of it, face it head on. Go get yourself some shooting lessons. Fear is based on an emotion that you have lost control of because of lack of understanding. Maybe try some meditation if it scares you. It's a wonderful tool to ease fear. And another one, please provide real examples of these so-called concealed carry killers. It seems you are contradicting your own reasoning by scaring the public by trying to convince them that those of us that carry a weapon to protect ourselves are going to go on a shooting rampage. Maybe you should consider taking a stroll down the streets of the real world and not behind a desk.
Well, let's go back to concealed carry killers. We just updated it when Trayvon Martin became just one more victim of concealed carry killers. And we have found that since May 2007, concealed handgun permit holders have killed 11 law enforcement officers. They've killed 391 private citizens. That includes suicides of the gun owners themselves. And they've committed 20 mass shootings. So this idea that, you know, if the gun you buy could affect only yourself and not your family, and not your friends or other people's family or other people, maybe the argument from the last email would make sense if you wanted to, you know, be very cynical about it. But the reality is that we have more than 30,000 dead in this country from guns every year. We are held hostage by an industry that is marketing with lethal less weapons possible. And yeah, as far as the concealed carry issue, the numbers are there. I mean, I know it takes time to go to a website and actually read the hundreds of cases that we have, but every case is a vignette, and it's the exact incidents that the people who promoted concealed carry said would never happen. It's domestic disputes, it's road rage, it's people shooting each other over parking spaces, it's fights at bars, it's assassinations at work, it's mass shootings in public spaces. These are people who, in theory, are supposed to protect us, and in fact, they're killing us.
We're talking about guns this hour of the program. Josh Sugarman, our guest this half hour, founder and executive director of the Violence Prevention Center. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of the show today, Othello, is the current show at the Milwaukee Repertory Theater. It's a modern and edgy adaptation set in the world of motorcycle gangs. Our guest, the director of Othello, who also is the artistic director of the Milwaukee Rep, and we will also be speaking with the actor who plays Othello. Back to phone calls, and we go to DeFosa, is it, from Madison?
Was that a Fulton?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thanks a lot for the show. This is amazing. I think one of the things that I found really interesting with the last guest was when you asked, when a caller asked how many times had he drawn his gun in self-defense, In the last 30 years, he had not drawn his gun in self-defense. Now, if we had compelling evidence that when people drew their guns, they were able to scare people away, they were able to avoid violence, then perhaps I would be in favor of everybody getting a gun to scare people away. But when people get guns, they don't think of getting this gun to scare someone away. A lot of us make erratic decisions, and we go on a shooting rampage. When we think about what's happening in Florida with Trayvon Martin, everybody is giving George Zimmerman the benefit of the doubt. Well, we don't really know what happened. He might have been attacked. What about Trayvon? A 17-year-old high school kid was so scared that he was running away. What about if he was applying his own stand your ground, right, saying, okay, now I have a chance. But we don't even know. But the idea that we give George Zimmerman the benefit of the doubt, a grown man who had a gun chasing a young kid, you know, I wonder if George Zimmerman were black and Trayvon Martin were white, if this would happen. You know, my kids are going to be black. And the idea that they would live in a society that would treat them this way is just amazing. So I'm obviously very very passionate about this. But you know, guns are not toys. They're very serious, and the repercussions for using them is usually death. So we should be very careful when we talk about guns and the right to carry arms and things of the sort.
Thank you. Thank you for the call. Josh.
Well, I think the caller raises a very important point, and that's that a lot of the attention has been focused on Florida's shoot-to-kill law and laws like that across the country. But the bottom line is that if George Zimmerman did not have a gun in his hand, was not allowed to carry a concealed handgun, Trayvon Martin would be alive today. And I think that's an issue that now is getting increased focus. I mean, just recently, Bill Cosby came out very publicly and said that, you know, this is not a race issue. This is a gun issue. Mm. And I think you're seeing a shift in public understanding once the debate over the shoot-to-kill laws has almost sort of cemented itself, and with the arrest of George Zimmerman, that now there's increased focus on how did that gun get into Zimmerman's hand and whose hand should these guns be in.
Another Facebook comment, this from another David. I'm an infantry combat vet. I didn't trust some guys I served with all too well, let alone someone with little or no training about discharging a firearm in a stressful situation. What bugs me is that I don't trust someone else around me carrying a gun. So how do I get away from that?
Well, what you have to do is become more vocal on this issue. I mean, what you find is that as your Facebook poster relayed, you know, there's a whole set of physiological and emotional responses that come into play when you draw a gun or you're placed in a situation where you feel compelled to draw a gun. And most people have never experienced it and quite honestly don't know how to handle it. And that's why people say, you know, they take their four-hour course, they read their magazines, and they brag to each other about how they carry and type of gun they have, and they better hope they're never in that type of situation. But quite honestly, until people start demanding that these laws be addressed, we argue that they be repealed, it's hard to address. A minimal first step that we would challenge the gun industry and the NRA is let's get data. Right now, all these crimes committed by concealed carry permit holders, it's secret. Let's make crimes committed by concealed carry permit holders part of the Uniform Crime Report's federal reporting data. Let's see who they're shooting. What's the incident that their gun is being fired? What other crimes are being committed by concealed handgun permit holders? Let's do it state by state. Let's start getting some answers. And that's the very first step.
1 minute left. Michael in Wauwatosa. Hi.
Hi. One of the concerns I always have is a lot of people tend to focus on people becoming cowboys, and when they have their guns, they're going to be going around shooting. And I guess I'm not so concerned about the people who go out and legitimately get guns, just like the gentleman representing the other side. I'm concerned about the criminals. What will the effect be on criminals when everyone carries a gun? That isn't going to stop crime. I think what it's going to do is breed a more violent type of criminal, someone who will just shoot you from a distance or come up behind you and hit you over the head with absolutely no warning because they know that they might get a gun out of that crime as well. So it seems like you're going to be breeding more violent criminals rather than stopping crime. You might stop some simple crimes, but you'll be promoting deadly crime, I guess.
Well, I think the caller raises an interesting question. We've seen an almost, I wouldn't say it's a parallel situation, but we have seen as firepower marketed in America, from six-shot revolvers to, you know, high-capacity pistols to assault pistols and assault rifles, up to 50-caliber sniper rifles today, what we have seen is there has been a domestic arms race. When you look at the types of weapons that police are now required to carry, they don't carry revolvers anymore. They all carry high-capacity pistols, patrol cars equipped with AR-15 assault rifles because of the types of guns carried by criminals. So we're already seeing a test case of that, and that doesn't benefit anybody, to be honest.
Josh, thank you so much for being with us. Josh Sugarman, founder and executive director of the Violence Policy Center. Before that, Jeff Nace, president of the Wisconsin Firearm Owners, Ranges, Clubs, and Educators. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. This is an issue that elicits a lot of passionate response. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of you, but we will talk about the issue again. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this interesting hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have news coming up, and then Othello.